Ms. Forsman?
Thank you, Your Honor. The jury in this case was told that Mary Kincaid Chauncey was guilty of a crime if she received anything from Lance Malone or Mike Gilardi, regardless of whether or not the receipt was defined by Nevada law, regardless of whether or not she was required by any law to disclose it, and regardless of whether or not she received the contribution, for instance, to her grandson's ski scholarship, regardless of whether or not that was received in exchange for any particular act that she was to perform. And on top of that, the jury was told that, and then the trial judge then removed a substantial portion of her ability to be able to prove the most important issue in the case, and I think the prosecutor would agree with this, that the whole case, since the jury was told there was no quid pro quo, that the whole case came down to what was her intent at the time that she received at least the two admitted payments. What the trial judge did was to misunderstand a rule of evidence and to fail to balance the rule of evidence against the right to present a defense.
Isn't that another way of saying that the district judge abuses discretion? Is that?
It isn't. It should not be an abuse of discretion standard when you're talking about completely removing her ability to put on her defense. It's constitutional.
I mean, she did put on a defense. She was allowed to produce evidence that was similar. The judge just made a decision as to what would be too burdensome. I mean, isn't that the kind of thing that the district judges?
Yeah, that's not what he did, though, Judge. He didn't make a decision that it was cumulative. He didn't make a decision that it was not relevant. He didn't make a decision that it was too burdensome. If that had been the case, then you're absolutely right. It would be an abuse of discretion standard. What he did instead was he went carefully through the direct examination of Mike Gilardi and made a determination on what could come in and what couldn't come in based upon whether Michael Gilardi specifically mentioned a name or specifically mentioned an event in his direct examination only. And that's where the misunderstanding of the rule comes in, is that the judge felt that if unless Michael Gilardi said on direct, I paid $100,000 to the mayor of the city of Las Vegas, unless he said that on direct, then the defense was then prevented from impeaching him with regard to all of the other things that he said on direct. Mr. Gilardi was portrayed as the victim of greedy politicians. In fact, that was a word that he used on direct. The prosecutor led him in on direct examination to his introduction to the world of Las Vegas politics by Michael McDonald, the city councilman, and Mr. Gilardi then talked about how he felt that he needed to pay off all of the politicians that he ever had contact with. And so he introduced the subject himself. The government introduced the subject themselves of the fact that here was poor Mr. Gilardi who was being victimized by the politicians. But then what they did was, is they said, well, but we're not going to talk about what he told the FBI. We're not going to talk about, and except when we want to use it as a prior consistent statement, which the government introduced his statements to the FBI and to his lawyers when he was trying to get a deal from the government, introduced those things to show that he was a truth teller. They needed Mike Gilardi. There's a suggestion in their brief that they really didn't need Mike Gilardi. That may well have been true for Dario Herrera because there was a lot of stuff on those tapes with regard to Dario Herrera making admissions on the tapes as to why he was taking the payments and what he was going to do and what the exchange of the emoluments was for. That is not true of Mary Kincaid Chauncey. They didn't have that. They needed Mike Gilardi to interpret terms, for instance.
The judge was pretty careful in going through witness by witness,
yes,
and explaining why he believed that you were not entitled to call those witnesses. He also authorized the defense, said, I will permit you to allow testimony from Tom Riley and from Schofield, mm-hmm. Mark Schofield. And you called Riley and you didn't call Schofield.
Correct.
So even one of the witnesses the district court allowed you to call, you didn't call. So how can you complain today that the district court didn't allow you to put on your defense when you didn't call one of the witnesses that he allowed you to call?
Well, I think the fact that trial counsel, and I can't tell you what the tactics of trial counsel were with regard to Mr. Schofield, But I think that the fact that trial counsel chose not to call one witness doesn't mean that the, that his vigorous argument on behalf of the other eight witnesses is waived.
Who's most important among those eight witnesses?
Well, there are really two sets of witnesses. Lynette Boggs McDonald was a witness, and let me sort of divide them as the government did in their brief. The fact of the matter is that there was a suggestion throughout the government's case that Lance Malone may have been pocketing money, although the government put Gilardi on to say he's an honest man and I didn't think he was taking any money. They needed to do that because they had the two admitted events that Mary Kincaid Chauncey admitted to, and then they had the two events where it was just her and Lance Malone together, and Gilardi needed to believe that Lance Malone, or the government needed to believe Gilardi, that money had passed hands. So Lynette Boggs McDonald is quite important because
this is for the theft theory.
This is for the theft theory, and because Gilardi said he gave Lance Malone $10,000 to give to Lynette Boggs McDonald. Lynette Boggs McDonald would have testified that she did not get $10,000, that she got $1,000. Now, the government says, well, that's not really what he even said in cross-examination, but that is what he said. And I can read to you from the excerpt of record, page 313. What he disputed, because Gilardi had real difficulties on cross recalling things that he had no difficulty recalling when he was talking to his lawyers to work out a deal or talking to the FBI to try to make himself valuable. But when he was on cross-examination, he said, actually, I said I didn't know if I had given her a cash or a check. He never said on cross-examination that he didn't recall giving her the $10,000, because the government would like to say, well, but then the fact that we impeached him with an inconsistent statement to the FBI that he did give her $10,000 doesn't matter because that's really not substantive evidence, and therefore you can't use the theory of reasonably within the scope of direct examination. And that's where the problem of the evidence rule comes in, is there was a substantial misunderstanding of that rule. And when you read the...
Was it a misunderstanding, or are you essentially claiming a constitutional override? I mean, that is, some of this, are you saying that it did come out in direct examination, or are you saying that the rule does not preclude contradiction, extrinsic evidence for cross-examination, or are you saying that there's a constitutional override?
Those are
three possibilities.
Judge, we're saying both. We're saying that to the extent that this court looks to that to the evidence rule as the basis for the ruling, the trial court misunderstood the rule and drew a bright line where the bright line shouldn't be drawn.
Because there is no bright line between direct and cross-examination.
That's correct.
Or because it came out on direct.
Because there is no bright line. In fact, the whole purpose of that rule is, in fact, in my...
What rule are we talking about, 608?
We're talking about the impeachment by contradiction. It's actually 607 is what this court's ruling in Tucker says. It's actually 607, which is just your general anybody can impeach anybody rule. And they make it clear that it's a 607 rule. They cite to Wright Miller.
It does draw this distinction, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't Tucker draw this distinction between...
They talk about direct and cross because of the facts of that case, but then they cite to Wright and Miller and to Weinstein's, and you can learn what the purpose of the rule is. It's what, in my old evidence class, was called an evidentiary harpoon, and what they call smuggling evidence in. In other words, that's exactly what was the case in Tucker. There was evidence that would not have come in absent the question on cross. And so the rule that's established is this reasonably within the scope of direct examination? Well, when you put Mike Gilardi up on the stand to say, I'm an honest man and I'm a victim of greedy politicians in Las Vegas, and I believe Lance Malone that he wouldn't steal my money. And when you put him up on direct examination for that purpose, and you put him up to interpret terms in the wiretaps, because remember, these are conversations between Malone and Gilardi, and he's the one the government was counting on to interpret what go to lunch means, what hook up means, what say hi means. Those were all things they needed Gilardi to be believed on for Mary Kincaid Chauncey's case. So reasonably within the scope of that direct is our ability then to come in and adduce extrinsic evidence that will demonstrate that Mike Gilardi is a liar, that Mike Gilardi was puffing everything, including what he was saying about Mary Kay.
There was plenty of evidence for that regarding it was used at great length in the closing argument, for example. So it's not as if there wasn't, both on the theft theory and on the liar theory, an enormous amount of evidence of that kind, which was used, and which was used quite plausibly and persuasively, actually.
The government's burden at this point, though, Judge, is to show you beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless.
And you're saying beyond a reasonable doubt
because of the constitutional question. Because the constitutional question. There were six. I'll list the witnesses for you that he went through in his ruling. There was Ardell Jorgensen, who would have.
Are these all on the theft theory, or this is on the liar
theory?
This
is now on the liar theory, Judge. Is that Ardell Jorgensen? These are the witnesses. Finally, there were three or four hearings, so it gets a little confusing because the list of witnesses changed as evidence was adduced during the trial. But if you look at the excerpt of record 353, Ardell Jorgensen, who was the head of licensing for Clark County, Gilardi said on cross that he gave her $20,000 in cash. If she had been called, she would have denied that she got that cash. Yvonne Atkinson Gates. Gilardi said on cross that she solicited $100,000
This was just a hearsay statement. There was just sort of nothing to it. She said $100,000 would make the whole thing go away. Is what he testified.
Correct.
And there's nothing else to that other than that statement.
Well, he is alleging that a county commissioner was soliciting a bribe of $100,000, and that county commissioner would say that's not true. It was in order to be able to make the problem at Jaguars go away, which was under the jurisdiction of the county commission. He's saying that Yvonne Atkinson Gates solicited $100,000.
This was not even a statement that was made to him.
He testified that he overheard it,
right.
That it was made to Malone, but he overheard the statement. He then tells the FBI that I've got this one too. I've got more of these things I can tell you about, and this is one of them I can tell you about. The jury was entitled to know that he said those things, that those things were false. All they got to hear was he made the allegation. They didn't get to hear that it was false.
Running low on time, you had mentioned a couple of other points in the opening. One of the things you mentioned is that I wasn't clear which one of these way you were going to pursue, but one of the things you mentioned was that the jury was not required to find there wasn't a requirement on state law to have it make a disclosure. It wasn't clear to me that was something you preserved in your brief.
That's not an instruction issue, no, Judge. That wasn't an objection because they weren't instructed that they didn't have to find it under Nevada law. What they were given was evidence showing that there was no law that prohibited what Mary Kay Chauncey disclosed.
Instruction didn't make it a requirement.
Right.
And you're not objecting to that.
I'm not objecting to that. It was the context of that instruction and the context of the evidence that was adduced that made this so damaging. The honest services fraud instruction basically boils the whole case down to what was in Mary Kincaid Chauncey's mind when she got the contribution to her grandson's ski school or the contribution to her son's city council campaign. What was in her mind?
With regard to disclosure or with regard to her intent?
They used the failure to disclose as circumstantial evidence of what was in her mind. So the only reason I mentioned disclosure is...
I thought there were alternative theories. One was under the honest services fraud. One was the intent to be influenced, the other was...
The other was failure to disclose.
Right. And if we thought the failure to disclose instruction wrong because it didn't say that there had to be some requirement, specific requirement to disclose, would that matter because there was another theory which was the more likely theory anyway?
The problem, of course, is that now you have two theories in the instruction.
Right.
We have no way of knowing what the jury bought, whether it was the failure to disclose. They certainly put on evidence of the failure to disclose. In fact, they walked through it and said, well, she didn't disclose that. and she didn't disclose that, and she didn't disclose that.
Was there any allegation that there was a state law requirement or a...
No, exactly the opposite. There was evidence put on saying there was no state, there was no, they put on the county manager who said, we really don't have a line that can be drawn on this.
It doesn't matter, since you don't object to the instruction, and you're not objecting to the instruction now, on that score.
Correct.
You're not objecting, you're not saying they should have been instructed that state law, federal law...
No.
...require disclosure. You're not making that argument.
I'm not making that argument. What I'm saying is that when you have that circumstance, the whole case boils down to what is in her mind. And when you're prevented from putting on the evidence that it would have helped with...
I would think that that's pretty good for you, for your client.
I'm sorry?
Since the government has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I would think that's pretty good for your client. To have it all boiled down to what's in her mind.
As long as you're able to put on your defense, it's pretty good for the client.
I'm confused about this. If you're not objecting to the breadth of the disclosure requirement in the instructions, then it doesn't boil down. Well, it boils down to what's in her mind only in that she had to know that she had an obligation to disclose. Is that why?
On the disclosure theory, the intent issue that I just raised is not relevant to the disclosure theory. Okay,
so
under the theory. Right.
But you've told Judge Kaczynski that you're not objecting to the fact that the disclosure theory encompasses some federal common law disclosure. Regardless.
Not objecting on that ground, no, Your Honor. And as long as, right now, we have no idea why the jury convicted under that instruction, because there were two completely separate theories included in the instructions.
So what? In other words, if she had...
We are objecting to that instruction, yes, we are. And so...
On what ground?
The objection to the theory with regard to the receipt, okay, is quid pro quo, is that there was no requirement for her that she receive the emoluments with intention to commit any particular act.
Okay.
What sense does quid pro quo make when the theory, there are two theories.
Mm-hmm.
And quid pro quo makes sense as the first theory, but on the fairness disclosed theory, quid pro quo makes no sense at all. It's nothing to do
with it. No, quid pro quo only has to do with the first theory, that's correct.
All right, but if you're not objecting to the second theory, and if they could have convicted on... You're not objecting to the second theory, is that right?
Reversal would be required because there were two theories contained in the instruction, and we don't know...
We don't know which way the jury found. But you are, in fact, not objecting to the second theory at all.
We don't have a preserved objection to that.
If the jury had not been instructed on the first theory, you'd be out of luck.
If there was only one theory in the instruction,
yes.
And it was only failure to disclose, because there was no objection made to that portion of the instruction, that's correct.
The reason you're not objecting is because there was no objection made.
That error was not preserved in this record, Your Honor.
You're not making a plain error objection.
I will if the court is willing to entertain it.
Well, we don't invite objections. you have to try it. What we say to it? I'm not particularly inviting it. You had mentioned it in the litany of issues before we got an evidentiary point.
Right.
This was one of the things you pointed to. And my recollection was that you really didn't have any brief objection to that. So if you're not raising it, you're not making, I'm not...
That's not an issue that's briefed in these briefs, Your Honor.
Okay.
Right. So to go to the other one, the Honest Services Wire for Instruction said that the official has to accept something of a value with an intent to be influenced. So your argument that there was no quid pro quo requirement is really that it wasn't a requirement of an explicit quid pro quo.
The quid pro quo is the tit for tat, this for that. That's basically what that means, is that the only way to circumscribe this crime, and as the court knows, I'm running out of time, but as the court knows, the honest services fraud was thrown into the wire fraud statute just as sort of a line at the end after a Supreme Court decision. And so there hasn't been a lot of development of this issue, but it's the this for that. The only way to circumscribe this crime so that it's contained in any way is to be able to require that at least the government be required to prove that the emolument be received in exchange for doing something in particular.
So why isn't accepting something of value with an intent to be influenced.
The quid pro quo would be not just influence generally forevermore. The quid pro quo would require that the jury, as it does in the Hobbs Act violation, that they actually find that it was with the intent to influence a particular act,
So what is it that you wanted in this instruction? What should the instruction have
said? The instruction should have included the same language that is in the Hobbs Act instruction, that it was received with the intent to commit a particular act.
But that's only with regard to a campaign contribution. I mean, in the Hobbs Act, I thought that in the Hobbs Act context, the concept of an intent to be influenced was possibly adequate under Ninth Circuit law, and I gather that there's
The Ninth Circuit really didn't rule on that because they didn't rule on the instruction, and the vast majority of the cases on the Hobbs Act require quid pro quo for both.
What in this instruction, in the Hobbs Act instruction, what is the instruction, the language that should have been given with regard to the other?
The court should not have modified the model instruction. The language that was, if you'll find it in my opening brief on page 14, the language that was added that completely diluted the quid pro quo requirement is found in the bolded language in the fourth paragraph down from the top of page 14.
So you're arguing that that instruction is wrong too, that they're both wrong.
Yes.
I still understand what the problem is. I want to make sure that I understand. So the instruction should have said, Ms. Kincaid-Chauncey received, the jury must find that she received money in exchange for a promise to vote on October 31st, whatever it was, 2002, for
in exchange for a promise to lift the building violations, or in exchange for a promise to do something in particular. Not just a general, because it's too dangerous this way. That's the problem, is that the crime is too dangerous.
What his understanding is, you're going to take the money, and we don't really need anything right this minute, but there's going to be a time when we're going to need to call on you, and at that point, you agree that you will do whatever we ask of you. Why does it have to be specific? Quid pro quo on a specific issue? Why is it
because
being on the payroll of the people enough?
Well, they didn't prove that. I mean, they proved that with some other politicians, but they certainly didn't prove that with Mary Kincaid-Chauncey. They didn't prove being on the payroll.
We're not talking jury instruction, not proof.
I'm sorry?
We're now talking jury instruction,
right.
Not proof.
But what
they proved is a different question. But why isn't it a perfectly proper instruction to say, look, if you took money without a particular understanding of your particular action, but simply took the money intending to be corrupted by it, that's enough. Why isn't
that enough? What would be enough is you took the money with the intent that when I call on you to vote my way, you'll vote my way. That's a particular act. When I call on you to vote on the all new dancing ordinance.
But you don't know what it is. You know, people in government offices often have lots of influence that can wield in various ways. Casting a vote is one thing. Calling up people in the bureaucracy and leaning on them is another way. Calling the police commission. You know, there are all sorts of things that she might do. I don't know how government works in Las Vegas, but just in general, these things are all connected. And let's say if you're talking about the LA City Council, well, the City Council person member were to call the Building Commission, for example, and exercise some authority. I bet you they would pay attention.
The problem is that there is an inability to distinguish what happened, at least with Mary Kincaid-Chauncey,
between regular lobbying activities. You took money, and in exchange for it, you were there and ready to need a favor. It's like calling the Godfather. You know, one day we will call you.
But look what the jury was allowed to convict on in this case. They convicted her for receiving a contribution to her son's her grandson's ski school.
If they believe that,
it was thousands of dollars that didn't have to come out of her pocket.
But she was listing it from a lot of people, and that was the evidence, is it wasn't just from him. He wasn't offering it to her for that. I mean, so because this instruction doesn't have any containment to
but
it, that it be a quid pro quo, that you're allowed to convict on something like this. If that counted, it stood alone. I'm sorry.
He seemed to be exactly the one that you agreed would be okay. It's a sufficient, if the public official understands that he or she is expected as a result of the payment to exercise particular kinds of influence as specific opportunities arise.
But that's exactly what we objected to. That's what should not be in the Hobbs Act.
But that's exactly like what you said before would be okay.
No, I did not. No, this is the paragraph that we objected to. This is what was added
to
the Hobbs Act.
What's wrong with that? Why doesn't that, if it doesn't have to be an explicit promise to perform a particular known act at the time, but rather a promise to do, you know, whatever we call on you to do, if we call on you to do it. Isn't that what that says?
Well, the 11th Circuit found that this exact language is not quid pro quo. Martinez case, which is cited in our briefs, says this is a dilution of the quid pro quo, that this is too dangerous. This would allow legitimate lobbying activities to become crimes.
All right, but then Tucker says that the government need not show an explicit agreement if it need only show that Tucker received the payment knowing that it was made in return for official acts. It's sufficient if he is expected as a result of the payment to exercise particular kinds of influence, i.e. on behalf of the payer as specific opportunities arise. So doesn't, I mean, aren't we bound by that?
No, you're not. And the reason you're not is that for the same reason that if I made a 29A argument based upon the insufficiency of the evidence, which was the only issue in Tucker, I could not stand up in front of you and say that the language of the instruction was wrong. And that's what happened in Tucker. They assumed that there was evidence of quid pro quo in the discussion. And they were merely talking about the kinds of proof that's available to the government.
They defined what quid pro quo was in a way that seems consistent with this.
And the model jury instructions have not been changed based upon Tucker to add this diluting language.
Counsel, one last question to go back to the witnesses that Judge Hicks excluded. If the principal issue before the jury is, let me back up. Ms. Kincaid-Chauncey admits to accepting money from Lance Malone on two occasions. She denies receiving money on two other occasions, which was there is testimony.
Correct.
So we do have two occasions on which she has received thousands of dollars from Lance Malone. If the question before the jury is, what is in Mary Kincaid-Chauncey's mind, why is the testimony of Lynette Boggs McDonald or Ms. Jorgensen or Mayor Goodman or anybody else been relevant to what's in her mind?
Lynette Boggs McDonald's testimony is directly relevant to be able to show the jury that Lance Malone, that those two occasions that she was convicted of taking money that she did not admit, that Lance Malone probably pocketed the money.
Okay,
that was the theory.
How does that help your client if there are still two occasions on which she admits receiving money and on which the jury can convict
her? Because the jury very easily could have found and could have believed Mary Kincaid-Chauncey when she admitted from day one to the FBI agents that she received these and that she did not believe she was receiving them for the purpose of influence or anything else.
So if...
But because of the two other incidents, because of the two other incidents which she did not admit.
Were the counts broken down by incident?
Yes.
And so she was convicted by the jury of receiving money on the occasion for her that she received it and admitted to receiving it.
Correct.
And the jury did find that she had evil intent at that time.
Because of the series of events. I don't think that
we
can sit here.
Well, if we were to agree with you that these witnesses were excluded, don't we have to affirm on those counts?
No, you do not, because the fact of the matter is the jury was not looking at the evidence. If we were, I believe that she would have been acquitted.
How does Lynette Boggs McDonald's testimony about receiving, whether she received $1,000 or $10,000, go to what was in Mary Kincaid-Chauncey's mind?
I think that the jury would have acquitted if the only two incidents were the ones that she admitted to. I think that
the jury convicted her on those specific incidents.
Because they were told not only that there were those two incidents, but there are these two other incidents in which Malone probably pocketed the money, in our view.
It's sort of a cumulative error?
No, it's the way they tried the case. No, it's exactly how they tried the case. He said it isn't just these two incidents. It is these four incidents.
Right,
it's these five incidents.
But the jury didn't have to find that she'd taken money on all four occasions in order to be able to convict her on certain counts.
But the jury wasn't looking at the two incidents that she admitted. and testified to in a vacuum. They were looking at them with the other two
because
events.
The jury did acquit her on one count, right?
They did. They acquitted her on a Hobbs Act count, but didn't acquit her on the identical count under the honest services fraud. So it's difficult to say what happened there.
Right. But those counts did relate to these specific instances that she admits receiving money.
The four counts do, yes. The Hobbs Act counts do, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm way over time.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Daniel Sheese. Let me start with the discussion that you had at the end, or just before the end, regarding the elements of the offenses and the jury instructions. There's two separate charges here, and the argument that's being made is improperly blurring the two charges and the elements. There is the Hobbs Act charge, which has as an element quid pro quo. And what the defendant's arguing is that element was insufficient. The instruction on quid pro quo was insufficient. Then there's their honest services fraud, which by statute and definition does not require a quid pro quo.
So you don't understand the instruction of accepting something of value with an intent to be influenced as a quid pro quo.
That has substantial overlap with a quid pro quo. You can take that similar type of instruction in the Hobbs Act and call it a quid pro quo. But the point of the honest services fraud is that it does not require a quid pro quo instruction. And what the defendant's asking you to do, the appellant's asking you to do, is to graft from the Hobbs Act.
What does it require?
It requires an intent to defraud or an intent to deceive. And the difference is the policy reasons behind it. The honest services.
To deceive or defraud whom? And it's strange because you're trying thinking about it. Usually, in order to have a deception or fraud, you have to be directed at someone in particular. Who?
In this case, the intent to defraud is to intent to defraud the public. And in Ms. Kincaid Chauncey's condition or situation, additionally, the county commission. She defrauded the public because she owed the public a duty of honest services. When she takes money with the intent to be improperly influenced, she is not voting from an honest position. She is voting from a corrupt position. She's deceiving the public by silently sitting at the front and telling them and voting them through their actions that she is honestly doing so, when the public doesn't know that she's taking money under the table. So the victim in the honest services fraud case is the public, deprived of her honest services. Now, in the honest services fraud, because it has as that element an intent to defraud or an intent to deceive, what the policy and the purpose is to stop fraudulent.
So the whole thing would be fixed if she went out and told everybody that he'd paid for her son's fee school and that would be fine?
No, because deception is not the only element or the requirement that's there. Whenever a public official deprives the public of the right to honest services, even if the public knows that they're taking a bribe, they still, through a scheme or artifice, deprive the public. And there's no requirement that there actually be deception in a fraudulent scheme. There is a scheme to defraud, and there is also schemes to deprive of valuable rights through misrepresentation.
Isn't fraud just in common legal usage include a misrepresentation of some kind?
Yes.
So what do you mean by there doesn't need to be one?
Well, in the sense that there does not need to be, and I need to back up a little bit on this, there doesn't need to be an express misrepresentation. It can be simply the appearance of, I'm doing something honest, I'm voting honestly, I'm voting on equal grounds. To the extent I said there is no deception, I didn't mean to be that broadly, in the limited extent of explicit versus implicit. And so going back to the honest services fraud, the required element is that intent to deceive. There is no argument, there's no basis to believe that that element is inadequate, that that element captures conduct that's not criminal. Now, what she argues is, well, let me give you a hypothetical, or not a hypothetical, let me take the facts of this case. Her argument is Ms. Kincaid Chauncey accepted money for her grandson's ski school. That in and of itself is not illegal. But if she took it with the intent to be improperly influenced on behalf of Michael Gilardi, she has acted with that intent to deceive, and she has then crossed the line into illegal conduct. There's no situation where a public official can take money or something of value in connection from a private party other than a statutory de minimis gift. But other than that situation, there's no situation where you can take money or something of value in connection with your public office.
What was the last sentence you said?
In connection with your public office.
No, but where's that in the instruction? The in connection of public office. Where was that in the instruction?
The instruction as it went through the honest services fraud talked about a public official cannot take something, and implicit within the concept of public official, cannot take something of value with the intent to be improperly influenced. Implicit in that is...
Improperly influenced in what?
You
might be improperly influenced in your dealings with your family. You might be improperly influenced in your dealings with your business partners. I mean, what if she takes money and the money is intended to get her to cheat on her business partners? I mean, she's involved in some sort of business, and this is intended to sell the partnership goods that are of fair quality. Where is that excluded by the instruction? Which instruction are we talking about now?
Instruction 26.
26. Hold on a second. I got it.
In the appellant's opening brief, it's quoted on page 12.
I have an instruction itself. You tell me where this excludes the possibility that she takes the money to be improperly influenced in her
public office, public position, starting with paragraph number one. At least as quoted in the appellant's brief, it starts off, public officials inherently owe to the public to act in the public's best interest.
Right.
If instead the public official accepts something of value with an intent to be influenced, the official has defrauded the public of the official's honest services, even though no tangible loss to the public has been shown, because the public official deprived the public of its right to honest and faithful government. Clearly implicit in that, in the context
the
of...
The one is implicit. So the point is you're saying it's not there, but it's we need to read into it. What you say it needs to be influenced, and there where the dash appears, you want to add the words influence in her official actions.
I believe a fair reading of that paragraph...
I'm asking you a question. That's what you want us to do. It may be perfectly fair, it may be a very good argument, but what you need us to do is to read those words into that instruction of the word influence.
Yes.
That's, if we say, no, we can't read those words, you lose.
I disagree.
No. You win anyway, even if we don't read those words into the instruction?
Well, you must find those...
You understand my question?
Yes, I do, clearly.
So you can win even if we don't read those words into the instruction?
No, you must.
So what I'm saying is you need us to read those words in. If we can't do that, if we won't do that, then the instruction is inadequate.
In that context, if you can't find that the instruction...
A yes or no would be good. Do you understand the question?
I understand
the question. If we can't buy into adding those words into the instruction, you lose. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, good. Let's talk about why we should read those words into the instruction.
The instruction as a whole conveys clearly that the public official must be acting in a public context. And I will focus on line one.
What's so difficult about adding the words in there? I mean, saying influence in her official actions. I mean, it's what's so difficult about adding, about stating exactly what you want? I mean, the instruction does everything except state that explicitly.
I mean, it should be added. There are only a few words.
Well, it's a little late. The jury is gone.
Is the salt in either paragraph 3 or 4 of that same instruction? We have the phrase, in the manner in which the public official makes his or her decisions, the next paragraph. If the public official understands that he or she is expected to exercise the official duties in favor of the contributor as a result of a campaign contribution.
Just by the, I don't know where you're reading from.
I'm reading from paragraph, 4 and 5. I said 3 and 4. It's 4 and 5.
Is it the paragraph starting, it is not necessary?
It is not necessary, and then the following paragraph.
Okay.
It's in the middle. It's in the middle of that paragraph.
Are you following the question? Go ahead and answer it.
If your question was, does that concept make clear that the instruction identified the act having to be an official act, the answer is yes.
And I'm sorry, which language are we talking about now?
The paragraph that begins, it is not necessary.
No, I got the paragraph. I'm talking about the language, means actual words.
Okay. Beginning with the sentence that starts, the offense of honest services fraud is not concerned with the wisdom or the results of the public official's decisions, but rather with the manner in which the public official makes his or her decision. Thus, the decision-making process may be corrupted and the public is deprived of honest services, even though the public official comes to the right decision for the wrong reason. I don't see how that can be read in any context other than the public official acting within the scope of his or her office.
The first sentence of the following paragraph ends with the words, it is made in return for official acts.
Yes.
What about something of value? Something of value, somebody's friendship, for example?
I'm sorry.
I think the overall problem is that this is very broad. And in addition to the intent to be influenced, to go back to the first paragraph again, the official accepts something of value. Now, in this case, it was asserted to be money, but it was also asserted to be essentially her family's goodwill because she was doing things for her family. Is that something of value?
It could be, but what she was accepting from the giver in this case was money. Was something of value. That concept of something of value actually...
What was a charitable... There was some talk of him giving charitable contributions to her favorite charities. Would that be something of value?
It could be if it was given with the intent to be improperly influenced.
So even if it wasn't given to her, it was given to somebody else, but what she got was the good feeling that her favorite charity was getting money, that would be accepting something of value?
Yes, because she was... It doesn't matter if she received it or if she directed it to somebody else. The something of value is what came from the giver. The focus doesn't have to be on whether she received satisfaction from it.
Something of value.
Excuse me?
She has to accept something of value.
She can accept in the larger sense of if she directs the money to go to her son or her grandson and she takes that from the public official than with that improper intent.
And the intent to be influenced, for example, could it include, if he calls me up, I'll listen to him, but he won't necessarily do anything as a result? Is that an intent to be influenced?
No, because...
Why?
Because listening...
Well, some people have access and some people don't. I mean, I will take his phone call. That's the influence. I won't take other people's phone calls. I'm too busy. I'll take his phone call.
There's a body of case law, go along the question that you have in the Ninth Circuit, and as I'm standing here, I'm not going to be able to tell you the name of the case. But generally speaking, as the court has limited honest services fraud in that context, simply buying access to a public official is not a, it doesn't always meet the element of an official act.
And how is the jury supposed to know that from this instruction?
Because in this instruction, when it talks about official acts, decisions, when it comes to the right decision for the wrong reason, when you act with the intent to defraud, through
the wrong reason, that doesn't seem to be to preclude the access theory at all. And in fact, I mean, there is some sense of that in the record here, very much so, that she was listening to these people and then often not doing what they asked her to do.
She would frequently do what they asked her to do.
And sometimes she wouldn't.
Sometimes she wouldn't.
Right.
But when she wouldn't, in the specific instance when she wouldn't, she was discussing that in connection with the July 31st, 2002 vote before the county commission. And she said to, or Lance Malone, who was speaking with her on the phone, said to her, I don't think Mike wants you to vote standing alone and get your head chopped off.
Also, there were things about who was going to be the public defender and who was going to be the building director or the something like that, the parks director. And in both instances, my recollection is that she was asked to do A and she did B.
Yeah. She doesn't, with the intent to be influenced, doesn't mean that she has to do the act.
So access, but you said access isn't good enough. So if she doesn't intend to do what they ask her to do, and she does not in fact do what they ask her to do, then what's the evidence that she intended to be influenced?
The evidence that she intended to be influenced comes from the many instances where she did what they wanted them to do.
But what I'm asking you is this. Does this instruction, how does this instruction negate an access theory?
It negates an access theory. It does not specifically state or carve out access. What it does, read as a whole, identifies a public official's official acts, and it talks in concepts of voting, of taking official steps.
An elliptical phrase in the first sentence that talks about being influenced. And why doesn't that include, I mean, if you want to say, well, it's going to include official acts, why doesn't it include the possibility of being influenced in the sense of picking up the phone and listening? You might be persuaded every time, but you're influenced if you pick up the phone and every time somebody calls. Well, how is that excluded?
You could read that into it. You could give that fact scenario, imply the jury instruction to it, but taken as a whole, I submit.
Well, you want us to read some stuff into it, but you don't want us to read other stuff into it.
Well, I mean, I was persuaded by your other thesis about the fact that it has to do with official acts, but so far I'm not terribly persuaded that it doesn't, that there's anything in here that negates an access theory as being sufficient.
Well,
you were very quick in that regard to answer yes to Judge Bybee's question about the last paragraph, but the last paragraph deals specifically with campaign contributions. And arguably, given that specifically it deals with campaign contributions, it talks about official acts, and then it doesn't say it elsewhere. The negative payment would be that the place where it's mentioned is not so limited.
Can I ask a question about the evidence question? I was not clear on. The district court judge seemed to have been very much influenced by what came out of cross and what came out of direct in terms of what he was going to allow to be contradicted by extrinsic evidence. But at least some of what came out that was relevant to this seems to have come out in stipulations. In other words, there were stipulations about who he would have said, what he said in his 302 statements about who he gave money to. Was that a cross or direct, or how do we know which it was?
It was a cross. There were many instances where the defense wanted to call witnesses who were either unavailable or to save time, and we knew what Michael Gilardi's prior inconsistent statements were, so we stipulated with the defense. Just simply read it in. The and that's a concept that I think is being overlooked by counsel, and that's this. For those six witnesses, what she wants to do is bring in public officials to contradict in part the statements that Michael Gilardi made pre-trial.
Right. In terms of the defense, which was that this guy was making things up in order to have the government give him a good deal, why does it matter if it was pre-trial or at trial?
Because the testimony that the jury heard, well, as to the defense, that they're going to make a good, that he was trying to make a good deal for himself, what she had was substantial evidence of prior inconsistent statements, impeachment evidence to show that Michael Gilardi said one thing before trial and he said another thing during trial.
But she's trying to say something else. Whether he was consistent or inconsistent, he makes up stories when it's to his benefit and only backs off them when somebody catches him. And why aren't the 302 statements usable for that purpose?
They were. And they were brought in. And the judge, as you will read on excerpt of
yes,
records,
but she has to be able to prove they weren't true. And the way that she wants to prove they weren't true is by putting on the people that he said did X.
The bottom line, what she's trying to prove is that he's a liar. And what she had was completely inconsistent statements before trial with what was said at trial, and the records replete with prior inconsistent statements, which gives her that.
But she's not simply trying to prove that he's a liar in general. She's trying to prove that he makes up having given money to people that he didn't in fact give the money to.
And that is undermined. His statement about that is destroyed by his inconsistent statements, where he says on some occasion, I did it and I didn't. For example, pre-trial, he said that he gave no money to former business licensing director Ardell Jorgensen. None. At trial, he says, I was with Lance Malone and he slipped $20,000 into her purse. Completely inconsistent. And it achieves the very objective that she's trying to achieve. And the judge's decision, when he analyzed this step at a time, was
actually it doesn't, because what she's trying to achieve is not to demonstrate again just that he's a liar and makes things up, but that he is a liar who makes things up when it's to his advantage to get a deal from the government.
The record in this case was absolutely replete with evidence of that. The district judge said that
making a harmless error argument. You're not saying that it was right to keep this stuff out.
Both. I'm saying it was right to keep it out on both a contradiction, impeachment of contradiction theory, and that the evidence came from cross-examination or the testimony that he wanted to directly impeach.
If one looked at it as a constitutional matter, I mean, what would be the constitutional reason for differentiating with regard to the ability of the defendant to put on their defense, whether the evidence that their contradiction came in direct or cross?
From a constitutional perspective, I don't know that there is a specific limitation, although the Supreme Court has stated that a constitutional right to present a case doesn't give a party unfettered right to put on evidence that's in violation of the rules of evidence or that is marginally relevant. And in this particular case, this case does not rise to a constitutional level. This case had...
Because they had enough possibility to put on both of these defendants.
Well, as the district court judge said when he, at the end of his ruling on 503, he said the defense is in a position to fully develop an arduous theory concerning fabrications and exaggerations by Gilardi because all of the prior, and the court said, the court has excluded no prior inconsistent statements that had been presented by or offered by the defense. And above that it said, and the evidence has been fully developed in the courtroom as to what the prior statements have been. We spent days in this trial with the defense bringing out not every prior inconsistent statement that Michael Gilardi had, and they were numerous. They were statements that he made in private in an attorney-client relationship to his attorneys. They were statements that he later made to the FBI when they interviewed him in Phoenix. They were statements when the FBI interviewed him on three or four separate occasions in Las Vegas. It literally, his prior statements filled binders of 3, 4, 5 inches thick. And they brought him in day after day. And so their theory...
Ultimately, was the district court's reason for not letting this in? At some point, he said it was because the statements were not... alleged that these payments were made to people, but didn't mention they were made illegally. At other points, he seemed to be saying it was because it was cross. At other points, he seemed to be saying it was because it was not a trial, it was in a 302 statement. So what is your understanding of the actual reason that he didn't allow this in?
I understood then and now that it was a compilation of all three, that he was looking at it as a whole, that at the outset he was taking the position, what did the witness say, what did Michael Gilardi say about the witness, and will the contradiction, the alleged contradiction, actually contradict it? That's one point. But then he was looking at, where did it come from? Was it developed on cross or was it developed on direct? So when he took all of those, he was looking at the rules as a whole.
Counsel, I want to return to a question that I asked Ms. Forsman. If we agreed with the appellate's position that that the public witnesses should have been allowed to testify, so Ms. Jorgensen, Lynette Box, McDonald, the mayor, and so on, does everything have to go back for trial?
No, not at all. First of all, when you look at the, let me take that one step at a time. In closing argument, Ms. Kincaid-Chauncey's lawyer said that Michael Gilardi is, I'm going to paraphrase it, in fact, I'll give you the exact quote. He said, and this is at the supplemental excerpts of record 520, he said, the evidence corroborates the suspicions of Michael Gilardi because he thinks he is bribing all of these people. It's going into the hands of Lance Malone, and then it never gets to the alleged recipient. On that particular issue of whether Gilardi gave the money to Malone and Malone delivered it to Kincaid-Chauncey, the defense elected to go with Malone as a thief theory and abandoned, for that limited issue, Gilardi as a liar theory. And the evidence that as it came into the recordings that set forth in the government's brief on pages 27 through 25 shows that every payment, and that a payment was made, was corroborated in tape or by FBI surveillance where they simply saw Ms. Kincaid-Chauncey where she was. None of it relied upon Michael Gilardi exclusively because everything he said was corroborated in tape. And so you don't need those people because the evidence as to the four payments, not just two, was so overwhelming. And when you look at one of the four payments that she claims that she accepted for her son for the legitimate reason of his campaign contribution, and you read the transcripts of the recording starting that morning throughout the day, it's absolutely clear that they're not talking about a campaign contribution. They're not talking about something for the son. They're talking about something for Mary Kincaid-Chauncey. And the recordings begin in the morning when Malone calls Mary Kincaid-Chauncey up and says, can I come over? Doesn't explain to her why he wants to come over. But he does say to her, or she asks him then, will you take care of my other son at the strip club? Yes. He gets to the house. There he calls Lance or Michael Gilardi with Mary Kincaid and hands the phone to her. And Mary Kincaid says to him, thank you. Absolutely silent on what she's thanking him for. And they have a discussion. Afterwards, Malone calls Gilardi. And they talk about, hey, things are going well with Mary. Malone gets home that evening.
What we know is that Malone was lying to Gilardi all the time.
Except when you get to the end of the day, Malone goes home. He calls Gilardi up and he says, hey, Mike, I think I didn't give Mary everything. I found $300 in my pocket.
I'm not talking with regard to whether he was taking money. I'm just saying he was lying to Gilardi a lot about his interactions with everybody, including what Mary was promising, what Kenny was promising and so on.
That's the allegations that the defense made.
It seemed quite plain from reading the documents that that was going on.
When those documents and the recordings were read as a whole, the defense strenuously argued that Malone was lying to Ghilardi about those matters. Our position was, when you read the recordings as a whole, and not merely take out excerpts from here or excerpts from there or look at one recording, you conceive that Malone was, probably with the exception of one instance, was being straight with Ghilardi. On one instance only.
What was the instance?
It had to do with an event that occurred, or a recording at about August of 2002. It followed the significant July 31st vote. And as I'm standing here, I don't have the exact date, but what it had to do with Aaron Kenny, the conversation was between Malone and Kenny, and she was saying to Malone, let's just tell Ghilardi something. And I don't remember the exact matter, but it was something important. Malone said, okay. Every other instance, when you look at a whole, the record supports that Malone was being candid with Ghilardi.
Thank you. Ms. Horsman, we used up your time. We'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you choose to take it.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. The one correction of the record that I think needs to be made is that some of the statements of Ghilardi to his attorneys and to the FBI, you can tell if you look at day 20 of the transcript, pages 2669 to 2677, which is the stipulation that the court questioned about, and what happened was is that Mr. Sheese wanted to put in prior consistent statements of Mr. Ghilardi, you know, because with under the rule that allows for prior consistent statements when there's been a challenge to recent fabrication. So those statements were not just coming in as inconsistency. And the questions from the court are absolutely right. This was not just a situation where, well, we're impeaching him because he makes inconsistent statements. With regard to each one of the public officials, which she sought to call, the jury was left with some mushy trial testimony because he was backing off of stuff by the time it got to trial, some more specific testimony with regard to, yes, I gave her $10,000, but I can't remember whether it was a cash or a check, and then no ability to be able to have Lynette Doggs McDonald, for instance, come in and say, I didn't get that money. Same thing with Ardell Jorgensen. Put it in the purse. But the jury never heard from Ardell Jorgensen.
How does that help if you've got Ghilardi, telling the FBI, I didn't give Jorgensen any money, and then coming on the stand and saying, I watched Malone put a Crown Royal bag into her purse with $20,000 in it. How are you aided by having her come and deny that she received the $20,000 when you've already got the principal witness, Ghilardi? And it seems like a sideshow to have Jorgensen be forced to come in here and deny this, when you already have Ghilardi saying A and not A.
Well, that proves he's a liar, although I'm very curious that the government would put a perjurer on the stand.
If she came in and said, yes, I got $20,000 in a Crown Royal bag, then Ghilardi would have been a liar the first time when he said, I didn't bribe her. So no matter what she testifies, Ghilardi's going to be made out to be a liar.
The jury needed to know from these officials that this man would make up payments, whether he was on the witness stand, whether he was in front of the FBI, or whether he was trying to cut a deal with his lawyers.
Do you understand a proffer as being a proffer that these people would actually testify? One thing that concerns me is I just find it very unlikely that many of them would have pleaded the Fifth Amendment.
No, I'm certain that Mr. Wright, Representative Mary Kay Chauncey, would not have listed them. In fact, that may be
your understanding is that it was a representation of that they
yes.
would.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. I think that, and I don't think there's any contention that it was inaccurate, and it may well be why some witnesses weren't called. They wouldn't if they did not receive the money. I suppose if they were still, I mean, maybe the prosecutor was standing back there with a target letter for all of them. I don't know. Thank you, Your Honor, for your time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Case is submitted.